Hello, patrons, and welcome to episode 5 of Underwood and Flinch Underground. Before we start, a quick reminder for those of you who may have missed the last podcast, the H.P. Lovecraft podcast, to those of you who have received notifications from Patreon about payment declined, and a subsequent email from me pointing out that you've had this notification and your subscription is in arrears. So if you have had that notification from Patreon and from me, then do please sort out your subscription by the end of the week, or unfortunately, I will have to delete you. And we don't want that, do we? Secondly, do please stay tuned right to the end of this podcast, because there is a blooper reel. And as you listen to it, you might think, well, what was that? I didn't notice anything there. But if you turn the volume up really loud, you can hear my stomach gurgling. Now, this is one of the worst things that can happen when you're recording. You're working away and all of a sudden your stomach starts kicking off for no good reason. Normally, if it's like a sort of a plane going over or a bunch of cars or motorbikes going past, you can just stop the recording, wait till it's gone and then resume. But with your stomach, it's just an unpredictable entity. You don't know when it's going to kick off, how long for, or what it's going to sound like. Of course, if you find that sort of thing, you know, rather gross and disgusting, then don't listen to the end. But personally, I find it really quite funny. Childish, I suppose. What can you do? Underwood and Flinch, Underground. A novel written and read by Mike Bennett. This podcast is intended for an adult audience. Episode 5. Five nights earlier. In the dream, he was buried in snow, encased in a cold, tight, suffocating grip. Had he been in an avalanche? Was he even the right way up? He'd remembered that you were supposed to spit if you found yourself buried by an avalanche. The saliva would sink towards the earth and show you which way you had to dig. He tried to spit, but couldn't. He couldn't move. He was rigid, paralyzed. Had he already started to freeze? As if to answer the question, his body was suddenly racked with a wave of agony from his stomach that forced him to convulse. He struck his head on something. A dull, metallic boom echoed around him. His eyes opened. Thank God, there was no snow. It had been a nightmare, and it was over. But something was wrong. He was shivering, freezing cold. Where was he? As his eyes began to focus, he realized he was staring up into a face, blurred and distorted. Then he recognized it was he, Dame O'Sullivan, a reflection on a smooth metal surface only inches away from him. He attempted to raise his hands to touch it, but his arms were stopped as they met sheet metal, freezing against his bare flesh. Another wave of pain, his stomach muscles cramping, causing him to double up, but he couldn't. His head smacked into his reflection. Terror now began to rake its nails down the walls of his mind. He lashed out in all directions, but everywhere he struck cold metal. He was buried, but not in snow. He was in a coffin, a metal coffin. He cried out, his throat dry as dusty parchment, so dry it hurt and made him cough. The sound of his coughing bounced back at him, resonating through the metal and fading away into the low electric hum. The hum that was all around him, constant and even. Then he realized They don't bury people in metal coffins, and coffins don't hum. He held his breath and tried to arrest his body's violent shivering so he could listen to the sounds around him. But there was nothing other than the hum, low, cold and constant. And then he understood. He was in cold storage. They must have thought he was dead. But who? He tried to remember, and through the freezing mist in his memory came a name. Sergei. They'd gone to Sergei's club, he and David Flinch. The grenade, the explosion. No, his mind moved forward and found Lydia. Lydia covered in blood. She'd become a vampire. He'd used a UV light as a weapon, and her face had burned like wax. But then the thugs had caught him, disarmed him, and Lydia, her teeth, Jesus, she'd bitten him. It had been good. Yes, he remembered. He'd never felt anything like it, a physical ecstasy that had surpassed that of any drug he'd ever taken. And then he'd passed out. And then what? They must have thought he was dead. Put his body in a freezer in the kitchen at La Fantasia. Or maybe they knew he wasn't dead, but did it anyway just to finish him off. And it would finish him off too if he didn't get out of there. He slammed the flat of his fists against the walls of his metal tomb and shouted, "Hey! Let me out of here! For fuck!" His cries broke into coughs, and again he struck out against the walls with his fists, the steel box booming in his ears. Then another thought filtered through the cold. Kitchen fridges didn't sound like this booming, resonant metal. And they didn't look like this either. They were coated with white plastic stuff on the inside. Not like this smooth metal surface. So there must be another explanation. His mind raced, and the picture it ultimately presented to him was almost worse than the kitchen freezer scenario. What if the fight was over and the cops had come? The cops and the ambulances, and him lying dead-like and with no pulse because Lydia had drunk so much of his blood. They'd mistaken him for one of the dead. That happened, didn't it? Your vital signs got so low they were undetectable, like in that old episode of Alfred Hitchcock Presents. And so this metal box was a mortuary fridge. He was in a morgue. "Help!" he roared, pounding at the walls. "Help me! Help! Anyone! I'm alive in here! I'm fucking alive!" He stopped, lay still, and listened. Nothing. He was alone, with only the chilling dead in the neighbouring drawers to hear him. "Oh, Jesus! Mary, Mother of God, no! Please, don't let me die like this!" His mind flashed images of morgues from TV hospital dramas, a wall of square steel doors, on each a handle. Push down on the handle, the door swings open, then pull out the body. It rolls out, head first, face up. That meant that the door was just beyond his head. He reached back, past his head, and touched smooth metal. A rap with his knuckles produced a hollow sound. The mechanism of the lock, doubtless enclosed and sealed within. "Fuck!" he shouted and smacked his hands against the door. The blow caused him to roll a short distance away. Of course, the metal tray he lay upon was on runners. There wasn't much leeway, maybe only 7 or 8 inches, but it was something. Having pushed himself as far as he could go, he lay his hands flat on the ceiling and pushed himself back toward the door as hard as he could. The tray rolled fast and struck the door with a clang. "Help!" he shouted, punching at the door. He pushed himself away again and repeated the action. To him, the sound of impact was loud enough to hurt his ears. But outside? There was no way of knowing. Despite dreadful fatigue, he continued to strike the door as hard as he could, until he felt something give in his left hand. He drew it close to his face and saw the index finger lolling at the knuckle joint. It was clearly broken, but there was no pain. Then he realized he couldn't actually feel his hands or his feet. The cold was taking him. There was no one outside. No one was coming. He was done for. But was it really so bad? At least he'd beaten Sergei, that was something. Despite the cold around him, he felt strangely warm. Warm and exhausted. So, let it go, he thought. Just let it go. He crossed his hands over his chest and closed his eyes to darkness. That was odd. He opened his eyes again. He could see the interior of the mortuary locker. How was that possible? It wasn't lit in any way, and yet he could see. Then, from somewhere beyond the electric hum, came a voice.
Hola! Hay alguien?
Damo stopped his breath. Had he heard that? A voice outside, distant, but real.
Help!
He thumped at the door behind his head, glad his hand was now numb.
Help me! Ayuda! Ayuda! Aquí!
From outside, the sound of muted swearing accompanied by rapidly approaching footsteps. Then, behind his head, the metal tomb resonated with the sound of the lock mechanism turning. And then the door swung open to blinding light. Damo closed his eyes and turned his face away, gasping incoherent sounds of relief and gratitude. His rescuer pulled out the tray on which Damo lay naked, his only adornment a written tag on the big toe of his right foot. Eyes still closed against the light, Damo listened to the stream of rapidly spoken Spanish, his mind now tuning in and beginning to follow it.
You're alive, his rescuer was saying. I don't understand how they could have made such a mistake. It's impossible. Gracias. Gracias,
Damo repeated over and over on shivering breaths. He opened his eyes to see his saviour standing over him, an orderly, a young man of not more than 25. But there was something wrong with him. He seemed to be almost aglow with a radiance Damo had never seen before. He blinked, trying to clear it from his eyes, afraid that his vision had been damaged by the cold somehow. As the orderly now darted around the room trying to find something to cover Damo with, it was like he was leaving a trail of heat in the air behind him. He returned with a light sheet and threw it over Damo's body. And as he did so, Damo saw how the veins and arteries beneath the man's skin radiated a fierce, strangely beckoning vitality. Then, pain in Damo's stomach twisted his insides and caused him to double up.
Shit, said the orderly. I gotta get you to a doctor. No,
said Damo, reaching out and catching the man by the wrist.
No, I don't need a doctor. I need food.
Food?
No, trust me, my friend, you've been in a coma. Refrigerated. Jesus Christ, it's a miracle. You have serious hypothermia. You have to see a doctor. No, stay.
Damo felt the heat from the man's wrist, his pulse strong and resonant. Without understanding what he was doing, he pulled the man closer, bringing the warm flesh of his wrist close to his lips. The orderly watched, confused and slightly alarmed, as Damo, his eyes closed, began to brush his lips over the palm of his hand.
Look, really, let me get you something hot to drink. I can get you some coffee.
A hot drink, thought Damo. Yes, that was it. That was exactly what his body needed. He opened his mouth and bit down on the orderly's wrist. Blood erupted into his mouth, hot, coppery, and unspeakably delicious. His body responded with a surge of desire, a confirmation that this was what it wanted. He swallowed, and immediately the pain in his stomach began to subside. He could hear the orderly crying out in shock and horror, feel him trying to pull his arm away. But Damo's grip on the man was like steel, which was strange, because he was expending almost no effort in holding on to him. Then a fist struck him in the face, once, twice. He caught it as it came in the third time, stopping it cold. Without opening his eyes, and with his hand now tight around the orderly's fist, he threw the punch back, smashing the man in his face with his own fist. He felt the man's full weight as he fell, unconscious, dangling from where he held him. Damo released him, letting the body drop to the floor, before climbing out of the tray to drop down beside his victim. Blood was flowing from the man's wrist. A voice in his mind was screaming at him to stop. For Christ's sake, stop! But the voice was wan, feeble and irrelevant, as his eyes went from the man's wrist to the greater heat at his neck. He lay down beside the man, pulling him to him like a lover, and felt his pulse beating against his lips. His canine teeth, now long and sharp, brushed over the vein, their points pressing against the skin. He felt the delicate tremor of the pulse travelling through them. Then, with a little more pressure, the skin broke, and the roar of blood filled the night. The orderly lay dead on the white-tiled floor. Damo, his broken finger now completely healed, sat in the corner, legs drawn close to his body, clutching them tightly and watching over his knees, watching and waiting for the dead man to awaken. He understood now what had happened to him. He was a vampire. Lydia's bite had changed him, and now his bite was going to change the orderly as well. He hadn't meant to kill him, hadn't really been aware of what he was doing at all. Only when the blood had stopped pumping did he come back to his senses. His initial reaction had been panic. That had turned to rage, and finally to tears. Now he just sat, wrapped in the sheet the orderly had given him, waiting for the dead man to stir back to life. He had no idea how long he had been sitting there. He wanted to leave, to run away from the scene of the crime, but he also wanted to be there when the man came back. He felt he owed him that, owed him some kind of explanation. Would someone come in and find them before that happened? Beyond the hum of the fridges, he could hear a distant television, perhaps in a staff rec room, but nothing else. No voices, no sounds of people working. The orderly must have been down here alone, working the graveyard shift with only the refrigerated dead for company. What time was it? He saw the dead man wore a watch. He uncurled himself and went back to the body, taking the man's wrist and twisting it so he could read the time. It was 2:30 a.m. He put the arm down and lifted the lid of one of the man's eyes. The pupil looked back at him, glassy and sightless. Damo leaned closer and said,
"Wake up, will you? I can't stay here forever, you know."
No, he couldn't stay here. Someone had to come along soon, and then what would he do? Hold up his hands and say it was an accident?
Sorry, he fell onto me teeth. Spilled his blood into me mouth. Yeah, all of it. Mental, isn't it?
Yeah, mental. He'd be arrested, and then what? It didn't bear thinking about. He had to get out of here. Instead of him hanging around to explain the story to the orderly, someone needed to be explaining the fucking story to him. And who better than the bitch that had done it to him? Yes, he had to find Lydia Flinch, had to hear what she had to say for herself. And then, when she was done talking, he'd finish what he'd started at La Fantasia and rip her fucking heart out. He cleaned up the mess as best he could, and now, wearing the orderly's clothes, Damo moved quietly down the corridors of the morgue. The clothes were tight on him, the trousers were too short in the leg, and he couldn't fasten the top button at the waist. Fortunately, the white smock covered that. He'd put the body in the cold storage locker that he'd vacated earlier. He'd even transferred his John Doe ID tag to the dead man's toe. He reasoned that if the next person to pull the drawer out didn't know the guy, the tag might buy him some time before someone who actually did know him copped on that John Doe was in fact their dear colleague. He checked the name badge on his smock, Raoul Mendez Castells. That is, of course, assuming Raoul didn't wake up and tell them himself who he was before he killed one or all of them. Damo now came up to the staff rec room and peered inside. It was empty. A chair faced a portable TV on which Clint Eastwood was delivering a tough, Dirty Harry speech in dubbed Spanish. On the table were a styrofoam cup, a packet of cigarettes, and a lighter. Damo walked in, pocketed the cigarettes and lighter, then continued on his way. In his pocket he also had car keys, a wallet with cash cards, money and ID, including a pass for the hospital car park. All he had to do was find the guy's car and then get out of there before the sun came up. He followed the signs for the exit. When he found it, he pushed through and came out in a basement car park. There were only four cars in sight. He took out the car keys and pushed the alarm fob. The indicators of a white Seat blinked in response. Damo hurried over and got in. He put the key in the ignition and was about to start it when he stopped. Where was he going? Where would Lydia be, assuming she had got out of La Fantasia alive? Hadn't David Flinch said she lived in the house he'd taken him to in the hills outside Almacena? If she wasn't there, then maybe David Flinch would be, maybe even Underwood, and he could surely help. But then again, maybe none of them had made it out alive. Damo certainly hadn't. And he wouldn't be making it out of here alive either if he didn't make a decision fast. He looked at the watch he had taken from the orderly. It was 3 in the morning. The sun would be up in about 3 hours. He started the engine. He could be in Almacena in 2. Well, 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 listeners. Damo Sullivan has risen from the grave. What will he find at Casa Underwood? Lydia Flinch? Or possibly the master of the house himself? Join me next time for episode 6 of Underwood and Flinch Underground. The music you're listening to is Ahmad Arma by Farid Farjad, courtesy of Taraneh Records, specialists in Persian music. Download the track from Amazon or iTunes, or simply follow sale links at mikebennettauthor.com or underwoodandflinch.com. Additional incidental music by Kevin MacLeod at incomptech.com.
Holmes.
Letting the body drop to the floor before climbing off the truck.
Holmes.
Did he come back fully to his senses? Did he...
Holmes.
Their points. Their points. Press. Their points. Pressing against...
Shut up, stomach!
Mike Bennett, author.com.
This podcast has been brought to you today by you. Yes, you. And all my other sponsors at Patreon. Thank you for supporting me, and to never forget that everything I produce from now on, be it on paper or on podcast, is as a result of your contribution.
Yeah! Woo, yeah!
I did a mini fist pump there, but obviously you couldn't see it.